You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to a new episode of Delirious Nomads, brought to you by Blacklight Media Records, a weekly podcast hosted by yours truly, celebrity chef Chris Santos. I hate calling myself that. And underground metal connoisseur Matt Bacon, who loves being called that. This is your new favorite podcast for all things heavy metal, as well as breakdowns of your favorite combat sports and riffing on some food talk every week with very special guests from across the globe.
Hello and welcome to Delirious Nomads, the Blacklight Media podcast. I'm your host, Matt Bacon, and today I have the greatest drummer in the world, hands down, as acknowledged by everyone I've ever met, Michael Cadenar. How are you, Mike?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Matt. How are you doing today?
I am good. Other than being the greatest drummer in the world, which I want to get into in a minute, you have a label, Silent Pendulum.
Yes.
Which has been going for a while, but really kind of started to get momentum in the past few years. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was always a passion project, and I would do my own bands or bands I really loved, doing vinyl primarily. But then once the pandemic happened, things just accelerated. So there was a demand for vinyl. There was interest. I was getting licenses for some of my favorite bands, including The Number 12 Looks Like You and Arsonist Get All the Girls, Into the Moat, Psyopus, a lot of that 2000s era mathcore stuff that was never done on vinyl. So that's where it started to kind of pick up. And then throughout COVID, I saw a real demand for more DIY and boutique label stuff. So I started signing new bands, some younger bands, and also started developing bands as well. Yeah.
So I want to talk about the license thing for a minute, because the way you do it is really interesting. You know, because ultimately, first of all, I guess the thing that makes me the most curious about what you do is how do you, when you're finding stuff to license, obviously the margin to profit is lower than if like you owned the rights. How do you identify the sales potential of stuff? How do you like find stuff that makes sense to reissue? How do you know you're not going to lose your ass on something?
Yeah, I mean, I consider myself a fan and collector and consumer as well as a label owner and musician. So as a fan, as somebody who enjoys going to concerts, who grew up with these bands, who had CDs in his car, me and I think a lot of people have a renewed interest in physical media and holding the record and seeing, you know, a picture into the past that is the 2000s, that is nostalgia. So as far as picking licenses, I mean, you know, I joined the reunion of The Number 12 Looks Like You and recorded the album Wild Gods, and we repressed the whole catalog, and some of them were first pressings. And that's really what sparked the idea. And I was like, wow, like people really care about these albums. And the only way to get it is on Discogs for $50 on a broken CD case. So I think, you know, that was the starting point. And I really saw that people cared. And then as far as today and going forward, I mean, I am involved in a lot of these communities, in the vinyl collecting community. I have a lot of friends there. So I get real-time feedback from people saying, hey, I would really love if you pressed XYZ, or if I see someone at a gig, they'll be like, oh, have you heard of this album? You know, it's on Metal Blade and it was never on vinyl. And I'm like, oh, I do love that album. So it's kind of, I'm always doing R&D and I'm always kind of doing reconnaissance to see like, okay, what could be a hit? What could keep us, you know, financially stable to continue to develop bands while also providing like top tier quality vinyl.
And I think that's a really interesting point you make about the reconnaissance, because I always say, I don't know if I'm really good at knowing who the next great band is, but I'm really good at knowing the guy who knows who the next great band is.
Yeah, I mean, you and I both live in Brooklyn now, and I see you at gigs all the time. We're always, you know, rubbing elbows. And I think that's a big thing, is being on the pulse. Even, you know, just seeing you last week at Escuela Grind. I mean, you were on the pulse, and it was a beautiful evening. I think those moments and those kind of evenings are super important for what you and I both do. Because if you're just sitting at your computer, you can do all the analytics and all the, you know, data sets you want. But until you really do it or go to a show or see like what the vibe is, then, you can lose your shirt.
And that's one of the things I find really interesting about like sort of the generations above us in sort of the music industry, is when you talk to those guys, like, it's amazing to me how much some of these like German metal label dudes who like don't do social media, how much time they'll spend reading comments, because they're just trying to understand like, how do people feel about this? You know what I mean? Like, this is what it is gauging the fan, whatever. What are you excited about right now with regards to the label?
Like what we just talked about, Escuela Grind. I think Grind is coming back in a mainstream sense. I'm really happy to see a lot of unique bands kind of getting elevated and getting the opportunities that they deserve with people like you, really putting them on, you know, giving them an opportunity to play big tours, big festivals. You and I are also, one of our close friends, Laurent, recently performed La Suspendida, a jazz metal opera in New York City. And that's something, you know, you and I both talked about a lot, and I'm getting involved with that. So that's something that's never been done before. So I'm really excited about, you know, new music and new concepts.
And I just want to point out, when you say jazz metal opera, that this is not Epica doing an opera. This is like weird avant-garde opera.
Absolutely.
I think that's an important distinction to make.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. With some of the best musicians in New York City and the world involved. So that's exciting. And then as far as just regular label and band stuff, I mean, I do 100% believe in every release I'm doing. We just did our first Japanese band called Seek, and I'll be touring with So Hideous.
Band is so cool.
Yeah. Super cool. Super nice guys. I played with them last time in Japan with Downfall of Gaia, but we'll be touring together in July. I'm excited about that. And then going forward, I mean, I have a strong hold with mathcore and deathcore and black metal, and I'm really excited to kind of explore some more industrial and experimental music. And I just recently joined a hip hop group called Eulogy out of Baltimore, and I'm excited to bring them aboard and kind of develop them with still having a foot in the metal world, but also kind of exploring different genres with the label and with my bands.
Absolutely. So then let's get into the music side, because you do a lot. You have Eulogy, which is completely different pretty much than anything else you typically do.
Yeah.
And then, but it kind of started for you, at least from what I understand, with Black Table, right?
Yes. So I think it all kind of happened around the same time when you and I met at Hellfest years ago with Downfall of Gaia. Around the same time I met Downfall of Gaia touring with my band Black Table in the US. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think Black Table might have played a show that you booked. If not, then it was Downfall of Gaia. But yeah, both bands kind of emerged at the same time. But yeah, I cut my teeth touring with Black Table for 2 years, and then met Downfall of Gaia, met you, and then opportunities just started kind of blossoming from there.
You know, so Downfall of Gaia are, you know, obviously sort of a post-black metal band on Metal Blade. But one of the things, I was joking about this with one of your dudes when I was in Germany. How have you toured Japan so much? You've got like the highest number of Japanese tours per Spotify monthly listeners of any German band ever. Talk about that. Because you have like this special connection. Now you're going back with So Hideous, who again are like a great band, but not like a huge act.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, there's always the joke and stereotype. I forgot what shows or cartoons had to be like, oh yeah, we're big in Japan was a thing.
Sure.
But we got our first opportunity just from a label there that did some cassettes and CDs of Downfall of Gaia, of Black Table. And we said, okay, like, yeah, let's go. I mean, the opportunity's there. And then we went from Japan to Australia and toured with our friends Hope Drone, who are also on Incredible Silent band. Pendulum. Great band, great people. So I think a lot of this, as you know, and as you speak a lot about, is the relationships and making those human connections and maintaining them with or without the internet. So, you know, sending an email, sending somebody a box, even if you spend $50 to ship a CD or vinyl to Japan, I mean, that means a lot to me and to people receiving it. And that sort of culture is, I think, how this keeps happening. Because I have really good friends now in Japan. I have really good friends in Russia and Europe, you know, Australia, from this kind of vibe. And I mean, I don't see them frequently, but when I do see them, there is this effort to be like, okay, let's really connect on these 5 days we have together. And sometimes those connections are stronger than someone you see on a daily basis. So it's a very interesting thing that I think only happens with touring bands, or specifically happens with musicians and touring bands or people in the music industry, as you know, too, you know, doing the festival circuit. You see someone once a year and you just connect and then be like, all right, I'll see you next year. And we'll just completely debrief that week.
Absolutely. And so, and you've just sort of mastered that in a weird way. And now you tour Japan every year.
I guess so. Yeah, that's what happened. And also just meeting the right people, like Seek, for example. They played with us and I just fell in love with their music. We kept in touch. Tokyo Jupiter Records as well did the Sohideous CD a year and a half ago. So they're the ones who invited us to Japan this time. And then with Downfall of Gaia, same thing. Just the right people invited us over for all those tours.
That's really cool. Because from what I understand, that's more how it works in Japan, is it's more about like, it's not like an American band finding a European booking agent. It's like someone reaches out and is like, yo, you should come.
Yeah. And it's a smaller country, of course, but they do have really strong communities and strong music networks for the bands and genres they love. Yeah.
So talk to me about that. Talk about building community. Both, does that, do you feel that emerges more from the touring musician aspect or from the label aspect, or is it kind of in tandem? Like, how does that work? Because you know, you're one of those guys where every time I post a picture with you, obviously I get a bunch of replies like, oh wow, he's so beautiful. But then the other replies I get, are like, oh, you know that guy? And they're like, every time we post a story together, there's like five replies like that. How do you build up the community like that so that you're sort of omnipresent in your own way? Because I think that's what a lot of people are trying to understand.
Yeah, I forgot what business book it is. Maybe it's all of them. But there's always a chapter that goes, rule number one, don't be an asshole, period. So I think that should be everyone's starting point before doing anything. A band, a label, trying to build a community, trying to follow whatever dream it is you have. So just be kind to everyone. I believe that every day. I mean, I say hi to every bodega owner. I say hi to people walking their dog on my block in Brooklyn. Like, I'm the guy saying hi to people. And they're like, why is that guy so happy? I'm like, well, I just want to say hi to everyone. I think it's important. So aside from that, I mean, as far as being in a band and having a label and the communities that we build through that, it's a lot of the stuff you talk about in your videos, which I watch and I agree with. And it's just being respectful, being on time, respecting other people's time, and having a genuine interest in what everyone is doing around you, the sound guy, the touring bands, the merchandiser, people, you know, fans coming to your show. So I think all those things together really help build a community because you're kind of putting your best foot forward.
I think the showing genuine interest thing is more important than people realize.
Yeah, because I mean, you and I can both see a person coming and just literally coming to us for their self gain, and that's it.
Yeah.
You can see that. You can smell it and see it a mile away. Even however hard you try to write an email or a Instagram DM, that's like copy pasta, whatever.
And I feel like everyone can kind of do that. Like everyone can, like, I feel like most people can kind of tell intent.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a little harder, I would say, in the pandemic a couple years with just everything's on the internet. It's, you know, you're doing video calls, but I mean, we can still see each other's eyes. And I think a big thing is that in-person thing, eye to eye, body language, all that. And just really seeing like, hey, I have a good feeling about this person. Let's elevate each other, or let's work together.
There's this really interesting piece with the seeing each other eye to eye on Zoom thing that I was reading, that part of the issue with why it doesn't feel real is that we're like an inappropriate distance away from each other. Like my nose is 18 inches from that, and then your nose, and that's like apparently not the amount of distance we're supposed to have. So that just makes it, even if I had like a bigger screen so you looked as big as you do in life.
Yeah. Or if you had a special camera that was like, you know, 360 or whatever, so I'd be closer. But yeah, there's something to be said about the in-person interaction and getting a vibe from a human. And then also just, again, back to intent. It's like, all right, when you start touring, you don't do it because like, hey, I want to be a millionaire and hey, I want to play XYZ gigantic festival. No, you do it because you love music and you do it to share your music and connect with people. And, you know, the older we both get, or the older anyone gets, I mean, you see the people in it for the right reasons. And then you also see like, okay, this is a cash grab. And you see so many bands that'll flare up and fizzle out, as opposed to like longevity, which is, I think your and my goal collectively is like, yeah, we want to build relationships for life, not just get a payday for tomorrow.
And it's funny how that longevity thing kind of plays out, because I feel like you and I, you a little less than me because you're a little older than I am, but I think that we both sort of went into the pandemic as like relative youth and kind of came out like someone like the main, like not the main, yeah, I don't want to be like super pretentious about it, but you know what I mean? Like I definitely felt like I graduated during the pandemic. And I feel like do you have a sense that you had that too? Because that's kind of how I perceived you.
Of course. I mean, we were both, of course, younger before the pandemic and also more prone to just be like, yeah, whatever, blah, 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 fuck around, whatever. But then 2 years later, 3 years later, whatever it is now, it's like, yeah, you and I are extremely serious about the things we do, you know, almost to a fault. We're like, this is it. This is business. Here's what we're doing. Here's what we're doing next year. Here's the plans. I'm learning this. I'm researching this. I'm hiring this guy to do that. So I think we both kind of graduated to a new level of operating and a new level of seriousness, because I mean, I think it was either we had to or we would have just failed, right? So we kind of had to step up. Yeah, we had to step up to the plate and excel. Yeah.
So, you know, so, okay, so just to circle back on the performing stuff, because, you know, I feel like with the label, there's like this trajectory. What are your goals performance-wise? You know, obviously you have Downfall of Gaia doing that thing. So Hideous is kind of in a similar lane, I think I'd be safe to say. You know, doing the Number 12 Looks Like You stuff is obviously sort of, I know that was like your band as a kid. And that's obviously very exciting. But where do you see yourself going next as a player?
Yeah, so last week, or this past weekend, I should say, I got a call to fill in for Imperial Triumphant and for the local drummer, Kenny Grahowski. So that was a really illuminating experience. And also our mutual friend has been calling me to do some drum recording work, Mark Urselli, Grammy Award-winning engineer in Manhattan. So I'm definitely gravitating towards that style for playing. And then for my personal projects, there's a lot of red tape because a lot of members have families, have serious careers out of music, mortgages, etc. So for my personal projects, I'm definitely gravitating more towards smaller groups or groups that can really get some stuff done. So Eulogy, my other group, This Is Oblivion, also a duo. So both these bands are pretty much mobilized. There doesn't have to be like, hey, can you do these four dates? Can you get a babysitter? Can you get off of work? It's like, we're on the same page. And it's like, hey, do you want to do 3 weeks opening for whoever? Yeah. Yes. One email done. One text message done. So I'm very much of the mind to have the least amount of inertia and the least amount of texts and emails and negotiations and just be like, okay, let's really give this a shot.
And I think that's something artists frequently don't understand, is sort of like, the hardest part of this isn't necessarily playing your instrument really well. Although obviously that's, you know, it's being able to reduce that friction and being able to be like, how can I set up my lifestyle to just kind of be quasi homeless most of the time?
Yeah.
And how do you do that? Because you have this record label, you have a bunch of obligations to other people. You don't have kids, but like you're, you know, you pay rent in Brooklyn. That's almost as bad as having a kid.
Yeah, basically. And I mean, I see a lot of these questions, I mean, in your career as well. It's like, how do you excel this? And I think the biggest thing is having the maturity to delegate tasks, to delegate full jobs. Because with the label, I was, for years, I was holding on so tightly that this is my baby and I'm going to pack the records and I'm going to do everything. I'm going to build my own website. During COVID, I mean, it got to the point where I was like, I physically can't do all these things. I need to give away a little bit control to people I trust and build this thing up. So I did get a social media manager. I did get a webmaster who's handling the whole website. I have a full-time graphic designer. I've worked with you for digital marketing because obviously that is way out of my brain sphere and I don't have time or interest to learn that skill. I respect it highly. Working on email marketing now with my webmaster. So basically, I think the best way to reduce inertia is to find the right people, to build a team, and to trust them and help them elevate everyone. Because I mean, the famous saying is a rising tide raises all ships, right? So if everyone's working together, sharing resources, then I mean, it's up no matter what.
As we kind of head towards the end on this, just to kind of start to wrap up on this label point, what do you feel, or even was there a defining moment where you were like, oh, this label thing is like big now? Like, obviously you had the epiphany where you're putting out this number 12 looks like you reissue and you're like, oh, okay. Like, clearly there's a bunch of stuff that nobody ever bothered to put out that I could just get a hold of because I know the right guy, which is cool. But was there a moment where you were like, not only can I do these reissues, but like, holy shit, this could be my job?
Yeah. I mean, towards the end of the pandemic, because I mean, I've done all sorts of jobs. So I gave lessons. I worked in the New York City Union doing labor. I did all sorts of things during the pandemic. But when those jobs fizzled out and the label was ramping up, I'm like, oh, I could maybe do this every day and just build it to something I could never imagine. So I would say it was towards the end of the pandemic. And I don't know if there was one release, but I think it was the point where we had like 2, 3, maybe 4 releases in a row sell out on pre-order on the same day. So I'm talking 24 hours. We sold out everything. I think once I got to like 3, 4, 5 of those, I was like, oh, okay. Like, this could be sustainable and I'm doing something that's significant and people care about. It's not just like, hey, I'm pressing this record I really love and it's obscure and unique. It's like, oh, there's 500 or 1,000 other people who value this as much as I do. Let me keep doing it for myself, for the community, and also just to keep historical significance in this medium.
And so the defining factor that really got you to that pro label place was building up that community and having it at a place where really kind of like this hand-to-hand combat, because there really is only like 2,000 like deep math core nerds in America. And you just kind of made sure that they all knew about you.
Yeah, absolutely. And back to community, I mean, Bandcamp was a really huge resource for me. I was posting updates all through the pandemic. People were commenting. I was in different Facebook groups. I respond to every Instagram comment, every Instagram DM, all the emails, customer service. I mean, I'm a big believer the customer is always right. You know, if there's an issue, be like, all right, let's figure this out. Because I mean, you are taking your time and money out of the day to talk to me and to support my music and my vision. So like, that's an honor. So that's where my head's always been. And I mean, the community is still there and they believe in what we're doing and the future, to the point where sometimes people just buy records from me and never even hearing it. They're like, all right, I trust you now. I'll pick this up. Let me see what it sounds like on vinyl. I won't even listen to the digital.
Yeah. Which is cool. And I think the way you have that personal side of it, where you're clearly just the biggest nerd for this stuff, really, really benefits you.
Yeah, I think in this day and age, you really have to know what you're doing and care about it. Because yeah, like you and I said earlier, you can sniff a fraud or sniff a bad intent a mile away, and the internet will do its job. If there's a label pressing bootlegs of something and not giving money to the band, I mean, they'll get called out. I see it every few months. People are like, oh, those are bad people. They just did that without even consulting the band. Like, okay, that's not cool.
As a side note, you know what I really don't grasp with that? I find it really frustrating is everyone seems to get upset about vinyl bootlegs, but nobody's upset about merch bootlegs. And I never like... I don't know, that always really threw me. Because like, I work with like Bathory, for example.
Yeah.
And Bathory has literally two approved designs. And it's the same. It's the sign of the Black Mark design. One is in a white print and the other is a yellow print. That's all you get. So everything else you see, unless it's someone who's like going to Europe, which is, you know, highly unlikely. And why do you think nobody cares about merch bootlegs versus vinyl? Like, I don't really have I don't know. It's just sort of something that's always bothered me.
The first thing that comes to mind, I would say, is the manufacturing process. So like a shirt, I mean, in this day and age, you can print a Bathory shirt in 24 hours. It'll be on my doorstep and I'll wear it. Like you go direct to, direct mail printing, whatever. Same with silk screening. Give it a week. You can get 100 made, go in front of the Blink-182 show and sell it if you want, whatever. So vinyl, I mean, that's a whole process. So it takes longer, it takes more money, first off, and it takes more details. And I think it's highly disrespectful. Let's say like Bathory, for example, like, oh, what if I just press 1,000 of one of the records that was never pressed or pressed once, and people are selling it on Discogs for $10,000 because it's just like relic and it's really important to the music community. And I just came here and just took an MP3, printed 1,000. I'm selling it to my friends. Like, you know, you'd be upset too if you had a copy and be like, oh, now my copy is worth less. And it's also someone is like, you know, taking away the value of this item. So I can see why vinyl collectors are like that. But the whole reason I brought that up though is because like I'm really big into consent, and I could buy a lot of licenses today, but I strongly believe in talking to the band first.
100%.
Seeing, hey, is this okay? Number one. Number two, do you want to be involved? If not, okay, just give me the blessing. I'll handle everything. Do you want to write, you know, an expanded, intro or like a biopic or something, you know, just be involved in any way. That was kind of more of the point I was getting at with that, with the bootlegs. Because some people have access to licenses, they'll press it, and the band will not even know about it.
And that's really frustrating.
Yeah, of course.
You know, like, oh, my music's being presented without my knowledge.
Yeah, but that's a huge topic to discuss, because unfortunately, the 90s and 2000s, those record contracts basically took everything from you if you didn't negotiate them out. So a lot of this, I mean, not a lot, all of this is legal. It's in the contract. The, you know, Sony, Metal Blade, Century, whatever, Warner, everybody, they're allowed to license it out. But it's the consent thing that is a little
lost,
tricky, lost. Yeah.
So as we wrap this up, is there anything I should have been asking that I missed?
You're pretty much on the pulse with everything. I mean, I see you pretty frequently. Yeah, I mean, that's basically everything I'm doing. The label, all the bands, and more session work. But that's basically it. And hopefully you and I'll be working together more and more.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, so that was awesome. Thank you everyone out there for listening to Delirious Nomads, sponsored by Blacklight Media. We will be coming back at you next week with another awesome guest. Be sure to follow Blacklight Media on socials for new music and more, and above all, keep it heavy.
Hey everyone, this is Tuck from Fit for a King, an off-road minivan. Every week I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.
Hello out there!
Yes, hello out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hayden, Backstreet's magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!